A man carrying a large sports bag walks into a pub in London on a fine spring evening, 30th of April 1999 at 5:30 p.m. He scans the growing crowd, gathering in anticipation of Friday night fun ahead of a long bank holiday weekend. He walks to the bar and orders a drink, placing the bag on the floor. He moves away from the bar and then quietly exits the premises at 6:05 p.m, leaving the bag behind. At 6:37 p.m, there is an explosion, blowing the front of the pub out and scattering debris onto the street and passers-by. Three people were killed and 79 were hurt, some with life-changing injuries. The bombing was the culmination of a series of three targeted attacks in London over a period of 13 days. A total of 140 people injured and three dead, all caused by one man. This is the case of David Copeland, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Murder Me on Monday podcast. I'm Cameron, and joined with me is Mother.
Hello.
So today's one is going to be based on Pride Month. I asked Mother about this the other week, if we can do it. Is this even going to be uploaded in the middle of, in Pride
yes.
Month?
Yes.
It will, won't it? Just yes. Be right at the end?
Yes.
Okay, better late than never. One thing I did encounter or consider is that it's quite hard to do a true crime podcast involving, you know, murder, etc., around a sensitive subject like Pride Month without it being like, look at all these queens that got killed, or
yeah,
look at all these group of people that were murdered because they're different. It's kind of hard to do it, but I think we did okay. I don't know, and I'm sure you'll tell us. So
we're here with a case that isn't quite what I remembered, and the mental gymnastics to get to the reason behind it is actually really tiring. I knew about the case, the specific episode that I just mentioned that I'm going to start with. I didn't know that the depths of the hatred that this guy had for the LGBT community, amongst many others. And as per usual, whilst researching, I learned a lot, but there's a hell of a lot of really, really bad reporting and very conflicting statements. I didn't realise that this guy was actually responsible for two earlier attacks, and it's sometimes known as the 1999 London nail bombings, although I only remembered the Admiral Duncan, which is what I started with. Cameron knows how twitchy I am at the mere mention of the IRA and its ilk, and I have worked in London on and off for many years, more years than I care to actually admit, but I wasn't working there at the time that this all went down. Bombings were something you actually had to live with in the 80s and 90s, and as bad as that sounds, and the IRA did spring to mind. Again, I didn't realise at the time that the ceasefire agreement with them had been in place for 2 years, so it was unlikely to be them.
Was that public knowledge that the ceasefire had been going on for 2 years at that point?
Yeah, but I think it's the same as with a lot of things. A lot of important news just sort of flies by you sometimes and you don't actually register it. It's quite odd. There was a lot of splinter groups and you never quite knew sometimes whether this could have been them. And I think a lot of people at the time jumped to the same conclusion from what I read in all the various reports. But the police at the time did say it was unlikely, and it turned out they actually knew who was responsible. But the tip had only been received by the Metropolitan Police an hour and a half before the bomb went off, so they didn't actually have a chance of stopping it in reality. So, 54 Old Compton Street is the address of the Admiral Duncan. It's well known as one of Soho's oldest gay pubs and has an interesting history dating back to 1832. You can actually read about it. I'll put it in the show notes. Now, not knowing the place, I asked a colleague who lives in London and was there at the time of the event. I asked them what their opinion of the pub was, and I got, oh God, never liked the place. Go and read the TripAdvisor reviews. So I did. Apparently, it's one room with a bar and a stage. It has regular karaoke and drag queen acts. Lots of tourists visit and people go after work before heading home. Most of the complaints I read were about overcrowding, which is obviously not a thing at the moment, and prices. But I think that's kind of expected for central London and Soho. The negative reviews appear to be 5 to 6 years old and seem probably fair grumbles. Positive ones are much newer, and we all know how much things have changed over the last 18 months. One review did make me laugh. It was complaining that the drag act hadn't shaved their chest. Probably never watched RuPaul then, and I've only seen it once myself. But I think there was one review that probably best summed the place up, from what I can tell. Again, it's old, but it said, "The bar hasn't changed in years, but why change? Good gay tourist spot. Old drag queens and tunes, a kiss and a boogie." So, back to the evening of the 30th of April, 1999.
I'm just thinking about a drag queen with a hairy chest now.
Yeah, I know, that kind of stuck with me as well.
Why is that something to complain about?
I just thought it was a weird thing to put in a review.
Yeah, you don't usually see that, do you? Like, the drag queen wasn't nearly as hairless as I'd like.
Yeah. So this bag being left was actually noticed by the bar manager, and apparently he was inspecting it when it blew up. Nearby Soho Square, which is, yeah, usually was packed with office workers on a Friday evening, became a makeshift treatment centre for the injured. The police cleared nearby streets amid fears that there might be a second device. Again, that was quite normal protocol, always expecting that there would be a second, bigger explosion.
Yeah, a lot of bombs tend to be, or at least things that I've read and watched, is they will set up a smaller bomb in one place, cause everyone else to run in one direction, and then set up a larger bomb in that fleeing zone.
Yeah, exactly. So they were following protocol, and I recognised this when I was reading this. Emergency services were obviously quickly on the scene, and survivors and injured were swiftly taken to four London hospitals, as individual A&Es couldn't actually cope with the amount of people needing help. The bar manager survived, but Andrea Dykes, aged 27, who was 4 months pregnant with her first child, died along with her friends Nick Moore and John Light, who was to be the baby's godfather. Andrea's husband, Julian, was seriously injured. The four friends had met up in the Admiral Duncan to celebrate Andrea's pregnancy before heading to the West End to watch the show. The Metropolitan Police Assistant Commissioner undertook to maintain a crime scene van outside the pub to take witness statements and gather evidence until the perpetrator was found. The van would be staffed entirely with openly gay and lesbian police officers, which really helped the community feel that they mattered. Relationships have been tempestuous for years between the Met Police and the LBG community. And even though things had massively improved, since a very high profile series of murders in the early 1990s, where the police did not connect the dots nor believe witnesses and could have and should have stopped the killings sooner.
Did the police not consider that it was because they were gay? Is that what you mean by them not connecting the dots?
Yeah. They just didn't think that these cases were connected. It was a huge, it's one I may do later. I don't know. It's quite twisted. Well, these are all twisted, aren't they?
I think, though, would that not be because you're concerned about pigeonholing it because it's that, and that might cause a sort of reduction in the awareness around it? So if you think, oh, it was only bombed because they were gay, then that might limit what you would do to search other avenues. So if you keep it broad until you think, oh, we've gone down every other aspect, not every other, of course, but you don't want to assume too much and then just pigeonhole it.
The bombing of the pub, definitely.
I would assume. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm an idiot.
The other case that I'm referring to, the Pope case, not so much so. But so what else had David Copeland done? Brixton Market had a bombing. This was the first one on Saturday, the 17th of April, 1999. It was in Electric Avenue in Brixton. It's an area of South London with a large black population. Side note, Electric Avenue. Eddie Grant sang about it. It was a massive hit in 1983, and I'm really, really showing my age here. It was actually built around 1980, and it's called such because it was the first street market to actually have electric lights. The bomb was made using explosive from fireworks, taped inside a sports bag, primed, and left in Brixton Market. The Brixton Market traders became suspicious, and one of them moved the bag to a less crowded area after seeing Copeland acting suspiciously. Two further moves of the bomb occurred by unconvinced traders, including the bomb being removed from the bag, which vanished, presumably stolen, which is where it ended up next to an Iceland supermarket. The traders were concerned.
Did they just leave it? Did they just like find the bomb and then take it out of the bag, go, oh, that's a bomb, put it down?
Yeah.
What happened?
They just literally left this, and it was obviously on show. It was no longer in the bag. And people were like, what the hell is this package? And again, as I said, we were very much aware you did need to keep an eye on strange packages. So they did call the police. The police arrived really quick, because if you think you've got a bomb, the police turn out fast. But it actually detonated just as they arrived at 5:25 p.m. 48 people were injured, many of them seriously, because the 4-inch nails, which are 100 millimetres, were packed around the bomb. And a 23-month-old baby whose skull was punctured by a nail. And I've actually seen the x-rays of that. That was horrific.
Yeah, there's, I don't know if you've seen the diagrams or pictures of what happens in a conventional explosion, which is like a concussive blast, isn't it? That's, that's like most grenades in media and real life and stuff, the deadly radius isn't as big as people think, and they tend not to immediately blow up buildings as well. It's more like a concussive blast in a small area that kills you first. But with shrapnel, when that goes through you, if you see a picture or of a wound where someone's been shot versus like a shrapnel thing or where the bullet's mangled mid-flight or whatever and then gone through someone, it's so different. It's so much worse because it just shreds and rips and tears wherever it goes through and just comes out the other end with almost another explosion. It's so much worse having these shrapnel bombs.
Yeah, well, I think you're immediately thinking bombs and a nail. There's a lot more to than well, just blowing.
A lot of them are like they'll do screws or nails. The fact it's a nail is almost irrelevant because when it gets when it's exploded, it don't matter what's going through you. It's going to go through you.
But you can end up with smaller bits which are a lot more deadly.
Anyway, we're getting into the weird minutiae. That doesn't matter. Carry on.
Right. So his second bombing is known as the Brick Lane bombing. That which was on the following Saturday, the 20th.
How much attention did this first one get?
It got a reasonable amount, but again, they didn't know the ins and outs, the whys and the wherefores, what it was. None of it actually made sense, but obviously they were, again, talking about all the different fringe organisations that claim responsibility for this. The police have got to investigate all of those, and they will. They will always get a bomb claim come through from, I don't know, up to 20 groups sometimes even more than that. So they've got to sift through that as well and go to all the intelligence communities. So they didn't really know, but then this second one went off. It was aimed at the Brick Lane in the East End of London, which has a large Bangladeshi community. Brick Lane is very famous for its curry houses and attracts a lot of visitors from all over the city and tourists. But he targeted...
Okay, it's a different day. We're recording on a different day than usual, and I can still hear the ice cream truck.
Yeah.
It's not even sunny. Okay, unrelated to the ice cream truck that you guys can now hear. The first street was called
Electric Avenue.
And this one's called Brick Lane.
Brick Lane, yeah.
Was it the first place to have bricks?
I've got no idea why it's called Brick Lane. I never even thought to look for that one.
Why is it called Brick Lane? Like, if we're going off that logic...
I don't know. Maybe it was paved with bricks.
Yeah, it just suddenly jumped into my head.
I was interested why electric, because as soon as I read about this, the Brixton bombing, and then it said Electric Avenue, and I'm like, oh my God, music from my youth. And then I went down and I read the lyrics, and I never knew. I'm really embarrassed now. I never knew that Eddie Grant was actually singing about this place in Brixton. But yeah, Brick Lane. So going back
in about 30 seconds, you're going to hear probably more ice cream sounds. By the way, yeah, just because it's still outside.
So. He targeted the market, which would be filled with local residents. It's a market. Locals use the markets. And it's the same as a Brixton market would have been. And it's significant, as it will go to motive, which I'll cover off later. So Copeland didn't know that the Saturday market in Brick Lane is less busy than the Sunday one, thankfully. When he rocked up with it with his primed sports bag, he realised his mistake. Again, no research, hadn't scoped the place out beforehand and didn't have a plan B.
And it's already primed at this point.
Yeah, oh yeah, he's primed. He's travelled in. I think one of them he went in via a taxi, which surprised me because I don't think...
He's got to be really either competent or confident in his bomb-making abilities because you can't even Google that stuff properly. I say properly, like I'm an advocate for it. You can't even Google that and find proper information.
You can't now, but you could then.
But Google wouldn't have existed.
No, but there was plenty of other search engines.
Yeah, but I mean, Dave... being astringent with checking it, probably not. But even then, like, how are you going to trust the information and what you find online?
Oh, we'll get onto that.
In those days.
We'll get onto that, right. You're going to laugh. But anyway, so he didn't have a plan B. And he had this thing on a timer. Now, he couldn't find a quiet corner to bloody well change the timer on. Could he? And he wouldn't have had the time to go home with it. So he just bloody left it on the corner of this place called Hanbury Street. So I'm not sure I believe the next bit either. But apparently it was picked up by a man who put it in the boot of his car and went to the police station on Brick Lane, which was shut. Again, not unusual. They shut a lot of police stations. Now, he apparently was on the phone to the police when it exploded in his boot, obviously writing off his car.
Did you mean shut as in it's shut for the day or gone?
Shut for the day.
Okay.
Sometimes they're part-time hours as well. Now, the reason I have my doubts about the way that that bit was reported, and I've read the same thing multiple places, but according to the map, it's a 5-minute walk from Hanbury Street to the police station, and it's less than 0.2 of a mile. So I'm not sure why you put it in the boot of your car to drive there, but there you go.
Might be faster, probably don't want to be carrying a bomb. I wouldn't want to be carrying a bomb.
He didn't know what it was. He didn't even open the bag, apparently.
So why did you go to the police station?
Exactly.
But then, You just said because you got these height of the IRA bombings. Or the people.
No, it wasn't the height. It was
okay,
after.
Okay, whatever. Splitting hairs. People are aware of these things. So you probably think, shit, fuck, someone left a thing there. I'm going to put it in my car and take it to the police station. Probably safer than me lugging it about by hand. I can get with that.
I thought he had no intentions of going to the police station with it. But I suspect that story was the only way we'd get an insurance payout for blowing up his car. Yeah. That was where my brain went, but that's me. 13 people were injured and the surrounding buildings and cars were seriously damaged. Now, that chap who put the bag in his boot for safekeeping actually did help the investigation enormously by containing the explosion.
I was going to say, did that blow up in the... So it blew up in the car?
Yeah.
When you said that in the first one, on Electric Avenue,
mm-hmm.
when that... the workmen found it, do you know what they were doing?
They weren't workmen, they were just market traders.
Oh, sorry. For some reason, when he said market traders, I heard traders, and then my brain went, oh, she means tradesmen.
No.
They found them on like a building site, because I was thinking, I'll chuck that in like a smet mixer or something. It's going to contain the blast, and then like the whatever, that's what I was thinking. But yeah, put them in the boot would have concealed the blast to a degree. Or contained it, sorry.
So yeah, it saved a lot of lives and further injuries, and it also helped the police recover the component parts of the bomb very quickly because obviously contained. So forensics backed up initial suspicions. The same bomber or bombers were behind both blasts. The police were able to recover a fragment of a clock face found in the boot of the car. And they identified the typeface on the fragment, which enabled them to trace the brand of clock and so on and so on. And they were rolling with the records, trying to find out, you know, who, the what, the why and the wherefore. Now, the police and the BBC also received calls from various groups, which we mentioned, claiming responsibility for each of the attacks. But the police didn't believe them. And they had suspicions that there was actually an emerging agenda of hate crimes aimed at different sectors of the community. And they were actually worried that there would be an attack on the Jewish community or even the LGBT, and did actually put out warnings anticipating another bomb the following Saturday. Investigators trawled through hundreds of hours of CCTV footage from Brixton Tube Station and the market that was going on. They were literally working 24 hours a day, the police around the clock. Tangent time. CCTV. I always thought the UK had the highest number of CCTV cameras in the world, but apparently we don't. A report published by the British Security Industry Association in 2020 estimates that the total number of CCTV cameras in the UK stands at somewhere between 4 and 6 million. That's around 7.5 cameras for every 100 people in the country. It's actually the third highest total on the planet behind the US and China. And only around 1 in 70 cameras are owned by local authorities. Instead, the majority of CCTV systems are owned by private businesses and organisations. But, according to the Office for National Statistics, there are around 13,900 CCTV cameras monitoring public spaces in London. I've got no idea who owns what or where.
That's that myth that if you're in London, you've probably been watched by several cameras. And I think that was done to dissuade crime,
mm-hmm.
because you think, fuck it, there's a camera everywhere. They're hidden in the pigeons, stuff like that, right? But but it's not true. And then people say that, oh, I got mugged or whatever on this street, and they're like, there were no cameras there, and that's just super common. And then people think, oh, I'm the only person that could get mugged in London with there's no cameras on it or whatever, and it's just not it's just not true. I know this is slightly unrelated, but in the States, at least, I've forgotten what they're called, and I don't know what the consensus is of people that are aware that these exist. There are these sort of, they're like sensors all the way. So think of like a market square or something. You've got sensors in different areas, and when there's a like gunshot or an explosion, because there's three different things, it can triangulate the location, and then when that goes off, it alerts like the police or the local law enforcement to go to that area. But I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think why that's a bad thing. But it might be because then if there's a loud noise for whatever that might happen to reach that the police go in there guns blazing and then people can get hurt from that.
This is true.
I'm not sure if that's the line that people think. I'm sure there are more intelligent people that would have either condoned it or said, no, this is shit. But I know that exists.
Yeah, and I've seen that.
And
yeah.
I think that I don't really think you can get that the same in the UK because we don't have as many gun crimes. But probably like a farmer shooting someone, we don't really get that so much in the UK.
Well, there is a big problem with certain gun crimes in certain... Yeah, we actually go back to Dale Cregan in Liverpool. And I've actually seen... You'll have seen the CCTV footage where he lobbed a grenade up someone's driveway.
Yes, I have seen that.
And it just went piff. It was really sad. Yeah, but that's a big gun crime problem up there. But that, yeah, they may well have that technology up there. But yeah, I've seen that. So back to this one. By Thursday, 29th of April, footage was actually released to the public of a man that the police actually believed was the perpetrator. They've gone on through these CCTVs. It was actually seen by Copeland. He decided to bring forward his next bombing because it was one day and he thought he was going to get caught before he could carry out the attack. And he'd learnt from his past mistake with Brick Lane and had actually scouted the area out in Soho. So he knew the demographics and he also knew his preferred targets and how busy it was going to be, which is where we come in at the beginning because this bombing was on a Friday. So within hours, David Copeland, aged 22, was being arrested at his home in Cove in Hampshire. At the time, police said a colleague had given Copeland's name to them after spotting him on the released CCTV footage from the earlier attack. Yet many years later, an undercover informant came forward and said that he had reported Copeland to his handlers, who had informed the police, but not in time to prevent the final bombing. Either way, when officers from the Met knocked on his door, he opened it and he readily admitted all three attacks. Yeah, they were all down to me. I did them on my own. He showed them his room, where two Nazi flags were hanging on a wall, along with a collection of photographs and newspaper stories about bombings. Bits and pieces have come out from Copeland's peace interviews that have been released. His motive. He wanted to start a race war. I'm quoting here. My main intent was to spread fear, resentment and hatred throughout this country. My aim was political. It was to cause a racial war in this country. There'd been a backlash from ethnic minorities and then all the white people would go out and vote for BNP, which is an acronym for the British National Party. That had me scratching my head at that statement as to why he would target the LGBT community. Until I read a quote where he stated he hated homosexuals and it was personal. He said a lot more than that, but it was all vile.
He's just worried that dicks are delicious.
It was horrible what he said, but you get the gist of it. And yeah, you could very well be right with that. So it's okay to have a violent, radical political agenda and tack on a personal hatred and wipe people out for that too. I just thought that was really odd. He'd let his pet rats run over the nails that he'd used in the bombs. Anyone who's ever had a rodent like that as a pet knows that they constantly urinate and defecate. They're like taps. It never stops. And I think that was to cause infections in the wounds if anyone survived. You can see where this is going with for the defence probably, can't you? So how did he even get to this stage? He'd been planning the bombing campaign for several months. Apparently he came up with the idea when a bomb went off in Centennial Park during the Olympic Games in Atlanta, which again, I remember that. He told the police that the Notting Hill Carnival was on about the same time and he began to wish that someone would blow up the Notting Hill Carnival. He woke up one day and decided he was going to do it. So Copeland wanted to make proper bombs, as opposed to whatever, I guess. In April 1997, he downloaded a manual called, we're back again, The Terrorist Handbook at a cyber cafe in Victoria, central London. But he found it difficult to follow the instructions for making one of the chemical ingredients and actually gave up. Apparently, one night in 1998, when he was bored, he looked at the manual again and saw instructions for making a pipe bomb, which was less sophisticated. So, referring to another guide on the internet, How to Make Bombs Part 2, he set about collecting the materials.
Sorry, I'm sighing and thinking, fuck me. Even this cafe that... Surely you'd have a red flag. You'd have some trigger words, wouldn't you?
So
this is going to respond somewhere and go, how to blow up XYZ or... how much uranium cost? You'd think, fuck that. Tell someone about this, wouldn't you?
Now you would, but 20 years ago...
But it's all going to appear on an internet history. So, yeah. Oh, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I know I'm much younger than this leads on. This happened when I was how old?
You two-ish?
Like, yeah. So, ish. I mean, I've grown up in a slightly different era, but that would have happened. That would have been one of the first things.
Yeah. So, apparently, Copeland had bought £1,500 worth, that's money, not weight, of fireworks from two stores in Farnborough in Hampshire.
Oh, I wonder what he's going to do with those.
Yeah. He'd bought ignition devices from a firm in Dorset, and he'd used old-fashioned alarm clocks as his timers.
Don't they now, if you like buy any of these things, you get put on a certain, like, your internet search of a certain signature attributed to you or your ISP or your, like, device or whatever. If you buy a certain amount of things that seem to trigger, if you get, like, a list of 3 out of 6, I think, fucking hang on. Like, if you buy fertilizer too much, yeah. People, obviously, because that's next, whatever. Yeah. But...
I know.
He bought, fuck me. Right, he bought 1,500 quid's worth of fireworks.
That's some, a lot.
Some nails and a mask. And the Miley Cyrus magazine. Like, what are you doing with that? You're doing something weird with that.
So,
fuck's sake.
Right. So, before heading to Brixton for his first attack, he experimented with different mixtures of flash powder to get the biggest explosion. He was blowing up small lengths of pipe at a common near his home. So, we're back to Albert Dryden blowing stuff up on. We again. Episode 15 available in the archives. Yeah.
Is that a plug to make people watch?
Listen. Yeah, well, not watching it. We're not on YouTube yet. So, before we get to the trial, let's find out a bit more about this absolute peach of a human being.
I thought you were going to call him a prick. No. It's closer, yeah. Carry on.
So, he was born in Isleworth, West London, on the 15th of May, 1976. He grew up with two brothers in Yateley, Hampshire, which is about 50 miles southwest of central London. His parents both describe him as absolutely normal. Didn't worry either of them about his behaviour. But at the age of 13, apparently, they took him to a GP as they were worried about his slow growth, height-wise. And apparently, the GP examined his genitals. Now, I wouldn't have thought that was unusual, actually.
What, a GP looking at?
A 13-year-old boy's genitals, because they could have been looking for Yeah, so hormone levels, blah. But he seems to have taken it to mean that his parents thought he was gay. And he seems
Why would that be the thing? I've got no problem with you short kings out there, you short queens. I mean, queens means two things in this context. Right? I'm not talking about that. If you're short and you think there's an issue with like your development, your endocrine system, your sex hormones, whatever.
Yep.
You're not getting like gonadotropic hormones that you'd want to grow. Why would you think, oh, he's gay?
He's 13 at this point.
No, but that leap in logic there seems to be. It's like if someone swears and you said, what did you say? And then they get aggressive with that. And then that means it was targeted at you kind of thing. Because there's almost like a disproportionate response to something. I would more be like, fuck, I'm not like developing at the right speed or whatever. I wouldn't immediately think, oh, my parents think I'm gay. And I don't care. Anyway.
Yeah. Again, I didn't say he was particularly logical. But he seems to have acquired the nickname of Mr. Angry by this point.
Well, by his... From who?
It's just general. It's a bit weird where that comes from because he's apparently his classmates say he was introverted. So where would the Mr. Angry come from? But this is out there. So again, as I mentioned in the beginning, some of the reporting is absolutely atrocious. So he studied at the local comprehensive and he got 7 GCSEs. So he left school at 16, which was the norm. He couldn't hack college, apparently, and he drifted into a few jobs, experimented with drink and drugs, and had a few minor brushes with the police. Now, he's also sometimes described as a tube train driver. Absolutely, categorically wrong. Really, really, really bad reporting. He did work with his father on the Jubilee Line extension. Dad was a mechanical engineer. Now, knowing that sector very well...
So his dad's educated, at least, then?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm surprised that he's... Yeah, sorry, I guess that's a bit of a weird leap for me to think, oh, he's... So, slightly going back, slight segue on a segue. Did you find out about him? Did he grow up to be of average height? What happened?
No, he didn't.
Oh, okay, I ain't going to play on the trailer about a short angry man, because that's not fair. Again, big up you short kings, right? So do we think that's why? Because he's maybe resented his height and he's gotten angry about it as well.
That was the start of it, but there's a lot more to it.
So now he's short, so he's annoyed about that. And now he thinks people think he's gay, which he doesn't like. So he's angry. But okay.
Yeah.
So now he's... Okay.
And he's been playing around with drink and drugs, which is another one. And I said, Dad worked on Jubilee Line Extension as mechanical engineer. I know that sector very, very well. Doesn't mean that the guy actually worked for Transport for London or LUL, which it probably would have been London Underground Limited in those days. Again, in those days, drug testing is very, very tight. It wouldn't have been hard for him to get a job with his dad. It really wouldn't have been. And he could have done really, really well for
himself.
Especially back then. Yeah, definitely. So once you've got a way in, keep your head down and stay clean.
That nepotism gets you everywhere, doesn't it?
It did then. It wouldn't now.
It even still does now, to a degree. Like, in an application for a job, they're looking for someone that's more related to someone else that works here, that's high up.
Within that sector, definitely. But his dad could have been a subcontractor, so it may not have actually helped an awful lot, but it would have given him that in.
It's an in, anyway, isn't it? Yeah.
But if he'd been taking drugs previously, and I know, as I said, I know they test, he very probably lost what actually turned out to be, he got an assistant engineer's role. So by the age of 19, when his parents got divorced, he seems to have just gone off at a really weird tangent. I don't know how he was financially supporting himself, and he wasn't living with relatives, but he was less than 10 miles away from his family home in Yateley in a bedsit that he rented off a local vicar after briefly moving to London to work on the Jubilee line. I was thinking he'd been doing night shifts probably by that point, and it's really difficult to get backwards and forwards. So after his arrest, Copeland claimed that he'd been having sadistic dreams from the age of 12. He thought about killing his classmates and wanted to be reincarnated as an SS officer. In May...
Reincarnated in the past?
No, we're dying and coming back as a... but there are still people out there that still follow the Nazi creed and actually have their own
ideology.
Groups.
Yeah, sorry. I thought... I'm like... Right, so... Okay.
Look on your face, it's hysterical.
I'm a bit like, fuck... Okay, sure. I mean, sure. Carry on.
Right. So in May 1997, he joined the British National Party. A year later, Copeland joined the National Socialist Movement. In 1998, he was...
Just so people didn't catch that, the National Socialist Movement are Nazis.
Yep.
That's what this stands for. So there's a difference between a socialist and like a nationalist. Mm-hmm. But when you're a National Socialist, that's what that means. So there's like... To be like, I mean, I struggle to understand why people have like immense amount of pride or whatever to the dirt they're born onto, but then so that's one thing. But like nationalist, then you've got like the socialist part, which is different from a socialist. There's like,
yeah,
the different things.
Yeah, it's like a conservative with a capital C or a lowercase C.
Yeah,
the two different things. So in 1998, he's prescribed antidepressants. That's no biggie. But he told his GP he was losing his mind. Now, nobody doubts that Copeland was suffering from some form of mental illness, but the severity of this condition was actually contested. So bear in mind, he's been arrested, he's talking with the police.
Again, he still could have it, but that's not a cause, rationale or justification. There are no justifications. There's a difference between a reason and an excuse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm late because there's traffic. That's the reason. The excuse... That you, an excuse would be like, I left late. That's not like the rationale for it. So, and you can have like depression and like schizophrenia or something, or like bipolar. As to what severity does that impact the thing that you've done?
Yeah, take your pick with this guy. You've just listed everything.
Oh.
Yeah. So on May the 2nd, 1999, police charged 22-year-old David Copeland with murder. Five psychiatrists concluded that he had been a paranoid schizophrenic for several years. Another consultant psychiatrist said that Copeland did have a personality disorder, but it was not serious enough for him to avoid a murder charge. A Broadmoor Hospital consultant had described him as psychotic and diagnosed schizophrenia. Prosecutors refused to accept a plea of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. They stated that he intended to kill or cause serious injury.
I think when it's so sophisticated as going out of your way to develop, make and research bombs, you lose that excuse of diminished mental capacity for it or mental reasoning. It's like if a physio is on the fifth floor and you climb up the stairs to see the physio, they say you clearly don't need a physio because you got to the fifth floor. It's that kind of rationale.
Yeah.
Like if you're...
Yeah.
If you're in, with it enough to be able to develop those things and those skills to make those stuff and then coordinate it, you're beyond that at that point.
Yeah, so they said that he actually had the mens rea, which is the intent formed for the planning and the actions, and he couldn't have had that if he was severely mentally ill. But whilst he was in prison on remand, they were never going to give him bail. Copeland wrote to a crime writer called Bernard O'Mahony, who posed as a woman called Patsy Scanlon in the hope of duping Copeland into confessing what his actual mental state really was.
Would that be considered entrapment at that point?
No, because he had got no no allegiance to the authorities. He was just a writer. But according to the Independent newspaper, the letters actually helped secure a conviction by giving the prosecutors evidence about Copeland's state of mind. Apparently it did help. Mentally ill, but not insane, I would surmise. So he was convicted of murder in June 2000 and given 6 life sentences with a minimum sentence of, what do you think?
I'm shit at this, and if I say one number, it's either going to be way too low, or I'm going to say another number, it's going to be way too high, and it's going to make the number you give seem bad. He's got sentenced to 6 life sentences with a minimum amount of... Wait, don't tell me. I don't know. 120 years. I don't know.
6 life sentences with a minimum sentence, I think, is actually really poor, because, again, we've got 6 murders.
Yeah.
He got a minimum of 30 years, which I think is quite low for 6. He would have got no different for 2 than he got for 6, I think, with that 30 years.
And I think it should be higher, because when the bomb is so indiscriminate, you could have killed how many people? You killed a child.
No, he didn't.
It went through the baby's head.
It was lodged in his brain, but it didn't kill him.
May as well have at that point.
Well, who knows what the aftermath damages are going to be.
Exactly. You're a baby. You get in the wood chipper. Fuck off. You lose sympathy. I'm sympathetic towards a lot of people on these things. This one's just annoyed me.
Well, hold on to your underwear, because you may actually cheer up a bit. So the judge said...
Why am I... Okay.
His avowed aim was to kill, maim and terrorise. His motivation was hatred of the communities he attacked. The making and laying of the explosive device was long planned and carried without compunction. And at the time, the judge said it would probably never be safe for him to be released. In 2007... Due to new legislation, Copeland's sentence was increased. He must serve a minimum prison sentence of 48 years, 10 months and 4 days from the date in 2000 when he was originally sentenced.
So if they can change the sentencing based on the new laws retroactively like this, why doesn't it happen in reverse?
I think this one was probably because of the minimum sentence he was sentenced to. They were able to change that.
I'm just thinking
that.
Of like drug crimes for, say, you get arrested and then sentenced for X amount of weed, and then weed gets legalized. Why are you still in prison for X amount of years when there are people that are allowed to sell it now? I know the argument is, well, it was illegal when you did it, and it's no longer. But then, for him, it wasn't as bad when he did it then, and now it is. So why does he get it? Do you know what I mean?
I think it was this minimum sentence that was being altered rather than anything else. I mean, you do have cases where people. Are sentenced under legislation many, many years after a crime, and it's they're sentenced for a pittance because at the time it was, you know...
Yeah, it wasn't deemed as harsh or as severe.
So Copeland was initially taken to the high-security Broadmoor Hospital, which we've discussed a few times. But as he was mentally ill but not criminally insane... It's probably the reason why I was transferred to Belmarsh Prison in 2004. Belmarsh is not a nice place either. Well, prisons aren't, but you know what I mean. But this guy, he couldn't stay out of trouble, could he? In June 2014, Copeland attacked a fellow prisoner with a shiv or a shank. The guy needed 10 stitches. Apparently, he'd been tormenting or goading Copeland the day before, and Copeland brooded on it. And the next day, he walked up to him and calmly slashed him across the face twice. This was the second time he'd been in trouble within a year, as he beat another prisoner up so badly that he was hospitalised, but he was never charged. I don't know whether they just didn't think there was a point. Copeland was actually found, the slashing offence, he was actually found guilty of wounding with intent. And he got another 3 years added to his sentence, which is a drop in the ocean when he's already doing a minimum 48 years, isn't
it? You're in for life, so why can't you do what you want at that point?
Yeah, I think this is kind of the problem we have with some of these, isn't it? So Copeland is now in his 40s and he's reportedly converted to Islam in prison. Apparently, it's a bid to find forgiveness and get a second chance. He prays every day and sees it of a way of showing people that he's reformed. Apparently, from what I've read, other prisoners that have come out, have served their sentences, have come out, they've actually talked to reporters. They don't believe a word of it. They think he's still, you know, every bit as bad as ever he was.
It's a long game.
Yeah. So David Copeland will now not be eligible for release until he's in his mid-70s, and then only if the parole board actually deems it safe to do so. He hasn't got a whole life tariff, which we've talked about before, but he may well, may as well have one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, time for case autopsy. Let's go and have a cup of coffee and we'll come back with a few ideas.
The ice cream truck went silently, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
So, case autopsy. We've got extremism, haven't we? We've got the ideological right wing. These are avowed Nazis. Why do they always want to start a race war? I don't get it. What is it with people thinking that they're Charlie Manson? Because it's the same, isn't it? He wanted to rile people up enough to attack each other based on perceived differences, be it religion, skin colour, or whoever you fall in love with. I really don't get the thinking behind that.
I think it's hard when you attribute so much of your personality to this thing that when society or the world you're involved with starts to counter those opinions, you almost take it personally because that's what you identify yourself as. It's like if you're a football fan and someone rips into your football team, they might attack you, and it's because they associate so much of themselves with that football team.
Yeah.
And this guy might associate himself so much with these like anti-gay, anti-LGBTQ stuff, the hates whatever, that, and he sees the world going in one direction, and he's taking that as a personal thing, or I don't know, just angry man. I don't know. Having such ideology about, cause it's like it's difficult because like he's obviously leaning towards like the fascist dictator authoritarian shit with the Nazi stuff. That it just seems really strange because a lot of these people that follow those kind of things, they themselves would be something that they would have direct conflict with, because maybe it's because he's got these like mental illnesses and stuff like that, that he would have been considered poorly within the like the Nazi regime, for example.
Yeah.
So it's kind of odd. It's almost like conspiracy theorists that they'll have conflicting conspiracy theories that argue with their conspiracy theories they agree with. So they'll think Bush did 9/11, but they'll think that so did the lizard people. And which one is it? So it's just really difficult, and I really struggle to rationalize or understand. A lot of these people I can sympathize with and agree, oh, you've had a hard upbringing or XYZ. But when you have just
hatred,
uncaged hatred towards someone like this, I just can't agree with that. It's different if like you tried to specifically blow someone up that was in there. Okay, you can't agree with it. Again, you're blowing up people indiscriminately. But it's not when there's just a blind attack like this.
On
such a shitty idea as well.
Well, yeah, but you've got his diagnosed mental illness, and apparently he absolutely refuses to accept he has schizophrenia, which apparently is very, very common with those that are actually diagnosed with it. So frustrations about trying to do this case. This case took three times longer than I normally would, because you probably realise now that I prefer to do things in chronological order. Me being me with this one, I had the Admiral Duncan in my head and I knew about that
one. Which is the last one.
Yeah. So I started with that one, but I didn't know about the other ones.
And as you said at the start, it was really hard to do a case around sort of Pride Month that wasn't just, oh, look at this person that was gay that got killed, or look at this person that was gay that killed these people, because then it's shining them in like a bad light, or maybe it's about trans rights, or it's about this and that, and it's kind of thinking, oh, fuck, this is hard to orchestrate this and it not be shitty. I guess this isn't quite so bad, because you're talking about a person that's done stuff to people in those communities rather than those communities themselves.
Yeah.
So I guess it is like loosely linked, like tangentially to...
Yeah, but he had a hatred for people based on the colour of their skin. And then he had this personal hatred of people by their sexuality. And anyway, the frustrations about researching this. Apparently there's a Netflix documentary that's been released very, very recently called Nail Bomber Manhunt. Apparently they spent months researching it. But again, I didn't watch it, but I read the write-ups, and that's why I didn't watch it. I'm seeing conflicting reports about what's out there and what was published at the time. Other documentaries I have watched have the same problems, which are available. Some places say the bar manager picked up the bag at the Admiral Duncan, some that it blew up in his face. Can't verify either of those claims.
Can't be both. You pick it up and then it blew up.
Yeah, you can do both, but they say either or. And then the one that I think they found the most logical one was he was just looking at it and it went up. How he didn't die, I don't know. Some say Copeland checked into a hotel under a false name, went to the pub at 5:30 with the bomb, and he walked away hearing the bomb go off as he did. Another said he went back to his hotel to watch it unfold on TV. Yet another one, person who was, he's described as a survivor of the bombing at the Admiral Duncan, said he felt the blast and he watched Copeland put his drink down, grunt at him and leave just as the bomb was going off. And I'm just like, no, I can't see that. I've heard that some reports say that he bought a Coke at the bar. Others says it was a pint. The colleague I asked said to me it's a beer place. So the pint actually does strike. But yeah, some places, some of these reports say it was 500 nails round each bomb. Others say 1,500. Again, the fireworks. 1,500 quid was the fireworks. That's a hell of a lot of bloody fireworks. That bothered me. With all the different reports on the pub bombing, I don't know yet why the first two attacks, actually the reporting on that seems to be fairly consistent. I've got no idea around that one. Now, the police officers that arrested him, it stated within one report with complete confidence that they were from Scotland Yard's flying squad. But the flying squad's purpose is to investigate robberies. They are armed, usually. So maybe that's why they asked him to pick him up. They would have had to have all sorts of permissions to go into neighbouring forces' areas to do this, armed or not. And to do it with only a few hours' notice, if that's true, it's impressive how fast they can cut through the red tape when needed.
I was just more impressed that you said that the police that stayed in the area after the bombing were part of the same communities, so that people would feel more at home. You don't really hear so much about that now, do you? So I'm kind of impressed that when this happened, it was.
Yeah, that's
because I'm thinking like with say there's been a murder at a rally about something like Black Lives Matter or something, it would generally be like white police there or something, which can then for whatever reason cause annoyance, aggravation. But it's like I'm surprised with something like this that it's
I think it was a deliberate move by the Met.
Yeah. I mean, obviously. But I'm impressed that back then that they would do this to that extent.
Well, they've been working on it for a while because, as I said, they'd gotten a number of high profile cases very, very wrong where they'd misjudged the community itself. So I think this was probably, you know, a really good way of redeeming themselves in the eyes of the community. And apart from some daft quibbling with some of these reports, whether these various sports bags, whether the Reebok or a head.
I mean, who cares?
Yeah, it was, oh God, that was bonkers.
If you're Reebok, you go, no, it wasn't us.
Yeah.
You don't have to be associated with the bomb.
There was some really ugly stuff too that's out there. And again, I'm going to preface it with the terms allegedly, as I only found it in one place and it's in the show notes, but my eyebrows went up into orbit when I read this. So, quoting, at his trial, it emerged that he'd always been tiny for his age and had never had a girlfriend and was terrified of being thought gay, not least because his family had taunted him about it since he was 13. None of this family expressed any remorse, and the bomber's brother was overheard wishing Copeland had used a gun so he could have chosen his targets better. I thought that was just the weirdest comment.
Is that what some reports have said?
Yeah.
Is there any?
No, found it in one place.
Oh, okay then.
Really? And
it's hard to believe when it's only one instance of reporting.
Yeah, and was it a case of the others shied away from it because of his supposed Nazi links and they didn't want to? I don't know. There was a weird comment elsewhere where somebody had written that his parents used to whistle or sing the theme tune of a popular kids' cartoon. And apparently Copeland took it that they were implying he was gay. I couldn't find it when I went looking for it again.
That's really common, though, as an insult, even from parents. Thinking, because back in the day, we I wasn't exactly involved with this process. Society developed a word for a man that takes care of themselves. They call them metrosexual, didn't they?
Yes.
I think it's shit where you have to develop an entire word or a classification for someone like that just because men are considered people that either don't take care of their appearance. And if you do that, you're immediately considered metrosexual or gay or inferior because you happen to take care of your appearance.
I don't think metrosexual is used much these days, is it?
Oh, no, it's not used at all because what is it? Mm. If anything, it's almost derogatory. Being male doesn't mean you don't take care of yourself. Like, because I do that, I pay attention to, like, skin, hair, face, whatever. And people are like, oh, that's gay. I'm like, why? You look like shit, I look better than you. If any, who's going to get more women from based on those response, right? So, I don't know. It's the same thing, and this is just a weird side tangent going on here. If you have children, don't comment or mock them based on, like, oh, if you've got a girlfriend, blah, 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 because that can make them have a weird hang-up about it. Yeah. There have been a lot of things, oh, if you've got a girlfriend or... a lot of things like that. I can't think of what the study said, but it's about how if you can influence them at their formative years about their romantic attraction and how that should be an embarrassment, it can stunt their development and growth and stuff like that. So again, if this guy's just being mocked about being gay and then being short or whatever, then that's...
Yep.
You're going to get these hang-ups about it. And then do you think he did these things because he'd had a girlfriend... People called him gay. He starts to think he's gay. He hates it because of his other ideologies, like the fascist Nazi stuff. That he then internalizes that and then represents it by trying to blow them up.
Added in mental illness anyway.
Yeah.
So he was a bomb himself waiting to go off, wasn't he? I think really realistically. So there was one positive development. We talked about changes of law and stuff like that. Julian Dykes, he was the husband of the lady who was
killed.
That's
a really unfortunate name for someone to be involved with something like this, isn't it?
Yeah. He got compensation for the death of his wife from the Criminal Compensation Board. But John Light's partner, Gary Partridge, wasn't allowed to get anything for his loss. And they changed the law to recognise same-sex couples under the Criminal Injuries Compensation Authority, which is
good.
Positive. Yeah. It's huge positive, yeah. Our government mucks up as usual. We don't expect anything less of them. The Home Secretary visited Brick Lane and Brixton, but not Soho. And he sent a junior minister instead, which wasn't received well. And then it went sort of too far the other way. It was a bit odd. Prince Charles took it upon himself to visit Soho. And he went to see people, but he didn't go to Brixton or Brick Lane. So that was all a bit...
I mean, I think at that point, though, that's almost like donation shaming. Oh, you only donated £1 million, but you earned £1 billion. It's like, yeah, but you still got £1 million. The outcome is you got £1 million. Just because he went to that one place, don't shit on him for doing it, because what you're going to get, you're going to foster a relationship where people don't go into it in the first place, because if you don't do 100% of it, you're going to get shat on for the 5% you didn't do.
But we're back to optics, aren't we?
Yeah, so if he wants to go there to show his support, or just for whatever, you shouldn't be... I don't want to say really cool, that's the wrong word, but you don't want to be...
Yeah, and it was good that Prince Charles did it, because I think that was much higher profile than the bloody Home Secretary
way higher
rocking
profile
up.
Than
yeah.
Secretary.
Yeah. So, jumping forward in time and just showing how stupid some authorities are. 2005, Westminster City Council ordered the Admiral Duncan and all other LGBT... I'm going to do it again. I can't get my tongue around the acronyms. LGBT bars and gay businesses that operated in its jurisdiction, including those in Soho and Covent Garden, to remove their pride flags. The council claimed that the flags constituted advertising, which was forbidden by its local development plan, and said businesses would need to apply for advertising permits to fly the flags. So they did. Some businesses who applied to fly flags had their applications refused. So, following pressure from the media and the Mayor of London, the council actually reversed its policy, which is good. Stupid things. Odd things. There was a memorial plaque in honour of the victims, and it was in a churchyard near to the Admiral Duncan. That went missing in 2013. Now, it wasn't one of those brass ones that metal thieves would sometimes take, or maybe a souvenir hunter, I don't know, a bit sick of it was. But apparently that was replaced quite quickly by the council and the charity, which was good. This one was rather unfortunate. The assistant bar manager at the time that the Admiral Duncan was bombed, and he was injured as well, was killed in October 2004. He was beaten to death by a group of teenagers who appear to have gone on to attack, beat and rob a lot of people in the area near the Royal Festival Hall on the South Bank in London. December 2005, four were sentenced.
What is Soho like in terms of a place to live in relation to crime? I don't know. I'm shit with geography. I don't even know where Soho is on the map. I could just point to London.
Soho these days is nowhere. Right. Soho was seedy. Soho was grubby. Soho was grotty. But it was
not because of the larger.
No, it was just a seedy area. That's the only way to describe it. And it was very run down. One of the worst areas was around King's Cross Station. King's Cross Station, if you were a woman, you didn't go to catch a train except when it was well lit after 6 o'clock at night. It was scary back in the 80s and 90s. When I was a child, I have a memory of a day out in London with my parents. And for some God unknown reason, we went through Soho. Being a child, I was, I think, about 7 or 8. I saw this big opening, it was like an open shop, but it to me, it looked like...
I wonder where you were going with that.
Well, it looked like an arcade at a seaside to me. I remember this. It was brightly lit and there was lots of flashing lights. And I was a kid.
You think it's an arcade?
Yeah. I thought it was an arcade. And back in the day as well, my parents being my parents, you didn't hold hands or anything like that. I just trudged along behind wherever they were going. And me being a kid, I just thought, ooh, bright lights, shiny. And off I went. And I've actually got a memory of being grabbed by the back of my coat and lifted up in the air and turned around and marched off. And it took years to find out, yes, I was heading into a sex show in the middle of Soho as a child. But that it was their damn fault. They shouldn't have taken me, should they?
I mean, that'd be funny.
God, could you imagine the hoo-ha that would have caused? So anyway, this poor assistant bar manager, he was killed. The four were actually caught and they were sentenced to 8 to 12 years for manslaughter as the jury didn't actually feel it was murder. There was no premeditation. They just went out. So going back to the Admiral Duncan, I mean, the Soho area. Soho is quite refined these days compared to what it was. I have been through it a couple of times in recent years and sort of, it's not till I've gone through it I've realised, oh my God, I've just walked through Soho. It's not, you can walk up, you walk past somewhere and you think, oh, there's Peppermint Rhino. It's not in your face like it once was. It's not that bad. Again, the Admiral Duncan, from the description of it, the only place I can say that I've actually been that would have been similar was a place called the Birdcage in Leeds, and I went there with another relative and we had an absolute blast with all the drag queens. But this was different. This was more like, my colleague said that they thought the Admiral, they didn't like the Admiral Duncan much. They said it's just this one long room. And they said at the time, couldn't even remember, but they think there were some bar stools, but there was nothing in the centre of the floor. And they said to me, I said, it sounds like an American bar. And they said, well, a pub to me is somewhere where you go in where you've got tables where you sit down.
I've read a description that's like a pub is somewhere you could take your dog. To chill out in, whereas a bar, you don't have that same atmosphere.
It's very, I don't know how, a pub is very British, isn't it? You know, when you walk in. I've been into some really weird pubs in my time where you're in a little tiny village in, say, somewhere like Norfolk, and you see a pub sign, because they've got signs that jut out, and it'll say, I don't know, the Red Bull or, something like that, the George Albert. And you walk in, and you literally walk in the door, and you realise you're in someone's sitting room. It's got literal a sofa and a table, and you look right, and you no more than four people could get in it, and you turn around and there's a hole in the wall.
It's a micro pub.
Yeah. No, they literally converted their living rooms, turned them into pubs. They're really weird. And of course you've got the other two people in the village and they just stand there and look at you and you turn around and walk out.
Because you're not loosely related to them.
Yeah, and you turn around and walk out. So going back to the Admiral Duncan, my colleague, they recommend a place around the corner in Russell Street. Said it's not seedy, which made me laugh. Yes, they said the Admiral Duncan has just got a feel about it. They said it can understand why people enjoy it, but this place in Russell Street is the place to go if you're actually looking to look at those kinds of entertainments.
Fair. So this little bit of trivia that I learned about drag queens the other day, some of them refer to each other as squirrels because they tuck their nuts away. And I thought that was really funny. And on that note, we're going to end the podcast. So thank you very much for listening. You can find us on Instagram and where?
No, we're not on Facebook. Instagram
and Twitter. Murder Me on Monday podcast and whatever the fuck. Great. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.
Peace.
Bye.